Financial technology, or fintech, is one of the fastest growing industries in the world today, with New York, London, Tel Aviv, Edinburgh, Singapore, Moscow, and other major cities all vying for a piece of the action. Welcome to Breaking Banks, the first dedicated radio show that focuses on how this new boom is changing everything, from the way we bank to the very concept of money itself. Now, here's your host, Brett King.
Welcome to Breaking Banks, the number one global fintech radio show and podcast. Now with over 6 million unique listeners in 177 countries, I'm JP Nichols, hosting this week. Today's show is sponsored in part by the Alloy Labs Alliance, a member-directed shared innovation lab and accelerator that reduces risks, lowers costs, and shortens the time between ideas and results. Founded by 12 leading U.S. community and regional banks, there are only 12 spots available to be a charter member and join the first peer work groups on P2P payments, digital onboarding, small business lending, and more. Once the charter memberships are gone, and they're gone forever. So banks can learn more and sign up for a live webinar at ftforge.com/alloy. Well, with that out of the way, we're going to talk today about the promises of personalization, unfulfilled and otherwise. You can add personalization to the list of capabilities enabled by new technologies that was supposed to revolutionize our banking experience, if not our entire lives. Did it happen already and we just missed it? Or does it remain beyond the horizon? Or what if it's not all that it's cracked up to be? This week, we'll look at the hype and the reality of personalization. So first name, percent sign 20 last name, this show is customized just for you. Now, if I did that right, that means that our AI-driven, voice-powered, deep learning intelligent assistant will automatically merge everyone's own name right into the top of the show. And then, well, I don't know, I guess that means we'll have better listener engagement or something. And co-hosting with me today is Chloe James. Chloe, welcome back to the show. Always glad to have you.
Thank you so much, JP. Great to be here. And I love that first name, percentage 20, last name. If that happened, we are better than we think.
We'll find out, I guess. Well, also joining us today is Penny Crossman, editor-at-large for American Banker, along with two of our regular contributors and guest hosts, Ron Shevlin, director of research for Cornerstone Advisors, and Jim Arus, co-publisher of the Financial Brand and publisher of the Digital Banking Report. So Chloe, I don't think we have a lot of conference announcements, but I think we have at least one. Do you want to go ahead with that?
Yeah, definitely. Love to give a shout out to this one. Breaking Banks is the podcast partner for Seamless Middle East, which is coming up next year, April 10th and 11th in beautiful Dubai. Seamless is a dynamic summit. I'm sure many of our listeners know about it. It's a large-scale exhibition. It brings together the convergence of e-commerce, retail, payments, fintech, of course, and identity. It's a two-day conference, and tickets are usually $1,500, but our lucky listeners will receive 50% off on the early bird rate, which is currently happening of $1,000 until just before Christmas, December 23rd, which means you can get a two-day conference pass to Seamless is absolutely awesome, I will say, for $500, saving $1,000 off the final ticket price. So to look into that, seamless-expo.com/ME. And I'll just give a shout out here as well that we would love, obviously, many people to get involved in the conversation today. So hit us up on Twitter at BreakingBanks1 or email us at info@provoke.fm.
Well, thanks. And, you know, before we jump into that main topic around personalization, we have quite a few things in the news. And Penny Crossman is joining us live from their Invest West conference in what I hear is sunny San Francisco today. Penny, welcome. What's going on in the news at American Banker?
Thank you, JP. Thank you for that nice plug for our conference. It's probably a little late for people to join us now, although we're still going today and tomorrow. So all that investment-related technology, robo-advisors, and so forth. One thing that is kind of interesting, we ran a story this week about how the Federal Reserve is thinking about putting together a real-time payment system in the U.S. As you guys probably all know, the U.S. is pretty behind the rest of the world in offering real-time or fast payments. Most payments, you know, except for, even with services like Venmo and Zelle, services like Venmo, most payments clear in, you know, 3 to 5 business days. And that's because of mechanization to do with the automated clearinghouse, which is advancing over time. But meanwhile, the U.S. has had this initiative for several years of trying to build a faster payment network, and an organization called the Clearinghouse went ahead and built something that does offer real-time push payments from one entity to another. The thing is that the Clearinghouse is owned by a small number of the largest banks in the country, and the community banks are kind of uncomfortable using a service that's owned by the big guys. So the Federal Reserve has said, oh, maybe we'll build something, a different real-time payment system. And, the Clearinghouse is pushing back saying, look, we've already built this. We're going to be reaching 50% of the country by the end of the year. The two things are not going to be compatible. It's going to cause a lot of confusion and breakages in the industry. So it's kind of the latest attempt in our country to catch up with the rest of the world. And it's one of those things where the more you try to get a number of large players to cooperate, the more complications arise. Another thing that we found interesting was the federal regulators in the U.S. There's a whole bunch of them. There's the OCC and the Federal Reserve and the FDIC and FINRA credit union regulator, they all put together a statement saying it's okay to experiment and try artificial intelligence in your efforts to detect money laundering. So, the banks actually all over the world are still getting hit with $100 million fines for not detecting money laundering, allowing criminals to do all kinds of things on their networks and not catching them out. Banks are expected to play the role of rule enforcer and law enforcement in a way when it comes to money laundering. And there have been a number of infractions that have been caught recently. And so the idea is that if you use artificial intelligence, you could take a much more intelligent approach to money laundering. But for quite a while, there's been an issue where the banks are afraid that if they go ahead and use this new, more intelligent software, they might end up filing fewer suspicious activity reports, which are these reports that say, hey, this person might be laundering money, or this person might be selling drugs because we have this red flag. And the idea is if one bank of a certain size has 1,000 suspicious activity reports and another just has 500, that the one with 500 could get penalized because the regulators might assume they're not doing their job. So it was just interesting in this world where artificial intelligence is gaining more and more importance to see regulators actually come out and say, go ahead, try this. We're not going to penalize you. We're not going to criticize you. And even if you're pilot shows there has been some money laundering and you haven't been catching it, we're not going to, throw the book at you necessarily. So,
well, do we want more reports or do we want more accurate reports?
Well, exactly. That's the wisdom. But when examiners come into a bank and do their examination, they're not always applying the highest wisdom. Sometimes it's like, well, look at this number versus that number. I think there's a little bit of a conflict between real life and the ultimate vision sometimes.
Sure. And back to your other story, too, about the Fed's quandary on building a real-time payment network or not, or to leverage Rails ACH. I mean, does this remind anybody else of the same kinds of machinations and issues that the retailers had as they were trying to band together?
You mean when they developed currency, that their joint payment network?
Yes, the previously named ISIS network, which turned out to be horrible,
the worst name ever. I think it's a similar dynamic where you have these big companies with big personalities, and wanting lots of control, and then you have smaller players who feel like, well, wait a minute, I don't want to use this thing that's owned by my biggest or controlled by my big competitors. I think that is a similar conflict that goes on.
The only thing I'd add into the real-time payments discussion there, which is kind of interesting, is the timing and the timeline that you talk about, Penny. And just given what Australia has been through in the last number of years with our real-time payments initiative and getting every bank on board and every person along that supply chain on board, it's actually been, it's stretched out. It was a lot longer than initially, I guess, anticipated. And I wonder whether the US will see something similar, or whether maybe they'll take learnings from an environment like Australia, who are further along the line with it.
I mean, that would be nice. I mean, it's already been 3 years, and you know, we've made a little progress, but it's I don't think we're I don't know that I mean, I think we see that other countries have done it, and the examples are out there. But I don't know if any other countries have as many financial institutions as we have. We still have around 8,000, you know. And
such a good point. Yeah.
It's just really hard to get everyone to agree on something, and to not have certain players want outsized control.
So, Penny, anything else on the top of your editor's list here today from American Banker? Because there'll be some other pieces of news I think Chloe and I also want to talk with the group about.
Sure. Well, just one more that we ran today. Well, two more quick ones. The Senate has confirmed the nomination of a new head of the Consumer Financial Protection Agency, which is a bureau, which is the organization that is supposed to be a watchdog that protects consumers' financial rights in the U.S. And it's kind of in the process of being dismantled by its current director, Mick Mulvaney, and he's nominated a successor who's like a follows his, you know, is very likely to follow the same policies he has been. Another one that was interesting is a company called Trustology that's a bunch of banks that left banks like BNY Mellon and UBS and Barclays and Goldman Sachs have formed a company called Trustology. It's a crypto asset startup. They have kind of a mobile wallet for keeping your digital currency secure. And, you know, I think it just shows this trend toward bankers realizing the rise of digital currency and starting companies to serve that market that the banks have not really been eager to serve or moving quickly to serve.
Right, great. Well, Jim or Ron, any thoughts on any of those stories before we move on to some other things in our news?
Not here, thanks, JP.
Great.
Yeah, I'm good.
All right. Well, glad you're both here. And Penny, glad you're here as well. Penny Crossman, editor-at-large for American Banker. So, you know, one of the other things that caught my eye this week, Jemima Kelly wrote an interesting piece in the Financial Times entitled, "A FinTech Sandbox Might Sound Like a Harmless Idea. It's Not." Now, I know from all of my friends in journalism and writing, the writer may not have written the headline. That might have been the editor's job, right, Penny? And I actually reached out to her, and she was going to join us, but she couldn't make it at this time today. So we're going to get her scheduled in coming weeks. So I think I'll save most of the discussion for then. But I said on Twitter that I wanted to talk about this with you, Ron, and Jim. I'm curious your thoughts. I thought she brought up a lot of good points, including that the role of the regulators is to protect consumers, not to provide PR for fintech companies. Not that we should blame the fintech companies for presenting it as PR. But in general, I'm in favor of sandboxes as a way of actually promoting more responsible innovation. Maybe, Ron, I'll turn to you first. What are your thoughts around this, if any?
Well, I think we've got to keep in mind that with any regulatory effort that happens, there are always unintended consequences. You look at, Sarbanes-Oxley, you look at Dodd-Frank and so forth, a lot of bad and unintended consequences. In this particular case, PR for the fintech company is not a primary objective of the regulatory effort or the sandbox. If it's a secondary or even tertiary effort or impact that happens, okay, so what? You're not there to provide PR for the fintech company, but reality is that's what it's going to do. So the writer focusing on this, you know, unintended consequence or this, you know, tertiary objective or impact of the effort without focusing first on what the primary focus was, which is most likely in many of these sandbox cases, is protection of the consumer with the recognition that technology is happening. The reality has been that the regulators and the legal environment have been woefully behind technological developments. And so a sandbox is a way of helping to catch the regulatory environment up with the technology developments. If it just so happens that some PR, that some fintech companies get PR out of it, okay. But for this writer to be focusing on that as a negative effect, I think is very misplaced.
Yeah. Jim, any thoughts?
Yeah, I'd agree. And I think the biggest challenge, and it's come up quite a bit lately, is that, you know, again, the fintech or the financial regulators are bankers. Okay, so there's two aspects here. One, there's going to be a real tentative and slow movement, and there has been. Secondly, sometimes the fintech sandbox may be a way for them to come up to speed as far as what's going on. I mean, it's an educational tool for them. And I think I agree that a fintech sandbox is a good idea. I don't think the regulators are going to turn their back on their objectives, but I think it may be a way, as it has been for a lot of financial institutions independently, to get up to speed on what's going on. And I don't know if there's another way to do that. They're not going to class, they're not doing things. And this may be a way for them to test the waters in all those aspects. So I do not, as Ron said, I do not see it as a PR move. It may raise the awareness of fintech providers, but I'm not too sure if that's a bad thing either.
Yeah. Well, we'll have Jemima on the show, and she can speak to, I think, a number of good points that she made. Chloe?
Yeah, I'd love to jump in here. I absolutely agree with the guys here. And interestingly, my early career was at the Australian Securities and Investments Commission, ASIC, in Australia before I moved to London to the Financial Services Authority between 2003 and 2011, 12. So I spent a lot of time actually working in a regulator during the financial crisis. Obviously, you do the math there, 2008, in the middle of that. And I actually think the sandbox and the regulators introducing sandboxes shows their commitment to really becoming entrenched in the industry with fintechs, but also with the traditional banks as well, as opposed to being an us and them type of environment, which in my personal opinion, it used to be prior to the GFC. So if this is the title of the article, I do agree that it's slightly misguided. I think it's a great idea. I know the people who are in charge of the sandbox at ASIC and at the FCA now in London, who are great people and doing excellent things. So there's my two cents.
Or what else is in the news, Chloe?
Yeah, so we've got another story. Probably can't do this podcast without mentioning Bitcoin and cryptocurrency. So our next story I just really wanted to chat about was obviously, despite this continued decline that we're seeing in the value of Bitcoin, cryptocurrencies do seem to be taking another step towards global legitimacy last week, as it was part of the conversation at that G20 summit in Argentina. They published this summary with a declaration entitled Building Consensus for Fair and Sustainable Development, which very briefly addressed crypto regulation. It was only mentioned once, in fact, and in the broader context of an open and resilient financial system. It is crucial to support sustainable growth. There are a couple of direct quotes there. Interesting to note in this piece as well, the G20 noted that it will introduce anti-money laundering and anti-terrorist measures per standards to fight money laundering. Penny was mentioning money laundering a little bit earlier and terrorist financing. So I would love to hear the whole panel today, really, their view on cryptocurrencies. Are they here to stay? Is it still a hype? Jim, Ron, what do you think?
It's funny. Cryptocurrencies to me was something I bought a little bit earlier than this time last year as some small Christmas gift to my son and my wife. They had increased
in their Christmas stocking.
Oh yes, and it increased quite a bit before Christmas. And
nice.
My son got very enthusiastic about it, and it was back when people were looking at the price virtually every hour to see how much it had gone up. But the reality is, at least the way it's structured right now and the way it's played out, is it's a speculative investment. It's not a currency. It is not a universal currency. I'm very skeptical on this overall, because it really takes an agreement across the board in every country for it to become, you know, a universal currency. So right now, and at least to me in the foreseeable future, it's a speculative investment that can be used for buying things. But, for anybody who stayed in it as long as some of us did, it certainly wouldn't be something I'd want to have it replace my dollar bills or my credit card.
Or even your gold chocolate coins that you usually get at Christmas.
And actually, what's interesting is I bought, like, medallions that were like an Ethereum and a Bitcoin medallion. And I believe right now those are worth more than the cryptocurrency I was representing with those. So, it's kind of funny.
Interesting. What's your view, Ron? What would you add to that view on cryptocurrencies?
I don't know who I'm quoting here. I forget what the source of this is. I'm pretty sure it was Pascal Bouvier who brought this to my attention and to everybody who follows him on Twitter. But somebody recently said, when it comes to cryptocurrency, there are two types of people: those who want to make a fast buck, and those who think it's around to fundamentally change the world. And I think both sides of the coin are falling short. I don't think you make a fast buck on it anymore, and nor do I see it as necessarily changing the world, especially in the short term. So, the third problem that kind of arises here is that it's getting mixed into the whole discussion around blockchain, which has a lot of potential use cases and value associated with it, but it's kind of muddying the water a bit. But strictly on the cryptocurrency side, I think both making the fast buck and fundamentally changing the world is falling far short of those objectives.
Well, I'll just keep continuing to steal the quote I heard from one of the regulators in Hong Kong. The crypto part's super interesting. It's the currency part we haven't figured out yet.
Yeah.
So,
which is kind of important.
If that's your plan, right? To Ron's point, if you like, I actually spoke to a bank not too long ago that they built their own cryptocurrency as an experiment. And what they found is they love the blockchain piece of it. And now they're moving some syndicated loans on blockchain. And the currency part was really just an experiment for their learning. And I think, some of the use cases are kind of heading that way.
Absolutely. I'm so interested to think 5 years ahead and what the conversation around this topic is going to be. I think it's fascinating, and it will be so interesting around that time.
Well, yeah, agreed. Other news, just last night, CUNA Mutual Group announced that they acquired Portland-based digital small business lending platform Mirador. So this comes just about a year after they took a minority stake in the company through its venture capital unit. And they say that they hope this will help credit unions grow their small business loans and deliver an exceptional lending experience for their members. So, Ron, is this the future of collaboration between financial institutions and fintechs? Are the banks and credit unions just going to buy up all the fintechs and then we'll call it good?
Yes. How's that for an answer? Absolutely. Who loses in that situation? The fintech providers get the fintech startups get their exit, the banks get their capability, their digital capabilities, and the borrowers get digital lending capabilities. It's a win-win around the horn. But all joking aside, yes, it is the future of it. Absolutely.
Jim, are you saying this?
Can I get this?
Yeah. Go ahead, Chloe.
Penny in there.
Sorry.
Just going to throw my two cents here. I do think there are entrepreneurs and companies that are fiercely independent. So I don't disagree with what you just said, but I think there are definitely fintechs out there that want to be independent, that want to challenge the establishment. You know, if you would include OnDeck and Sparrow and MoneyLion and there are a number of lending companies and also capital, companies that are offering kind of an alternative to digital banking. So I do think there's
so OnDeck, who's who's basically partnered with Chase and is now doing, they're, you know, the reality, I totally agree that, yes, there's those are that are independent. It's not about independence. It's about business model. And, yes, there are those that will continue and want to be direct to consumer. But as we saw 10 years ago, 15 years ago with the dot-com movement, you know, it's expensive to build a direct-to-consumer model where you can where you can go to a B2B model and leverage the existing consumer base and reach and awareness that the large financial institutions and even established financial, not even necessarily large, have. So it's about business model. And so to your point, JP, is that, and to your question, I think many fintech startups are going to find that the more profitable model is going B2B and versus B2C just because of the economics of the environment.
Yeah, but how many banks are really capable, or credit unions, or, you know, this was a CUSO in this case, but how many are really capable? I find many of them are
capable of what? That's the whole point of the CUNA Mutual acquisition, is that first of all, it's about Mirador's capabilities. Their ability to reach 8,000 credit unions or 4,000 community banks is hampered by their inability to make those kind of investments in distribution channel and sales.
I agree.
Going through CUNA Mutual, they have established their ability to scale, and through the existing relationships that CUNA Mutual has with credit unions, enables a much safer, less risky, and it'd be easier path to integration for credit unions. So again, it's a big win-win for all parties involved.
Yeah, no, I agree.
Question, Ron. Real question, guys. I mean, so they acquired Mirador. Is there any reason why CUNA or any other organization, say a major provider of back office systems, wouldn't acquire multiple companies to provide their clients the ability to actually build almost like a cloud or a new banking ecosystem, where really using the type of information we're talking about already, where you have five or six different lending companies that you can then use for your customers to actually pick which one they prefer to work with or to take multiple stands with regard to the technology?
Yeah, they're definitely doing that, Jim, and it goes back to the business model. I'm not sure CUNA Mutual is going that direction, but you're really talking about becoming more of a platform. And in the credit union space, you've got Constellation. I like to call them a platform services provider, you know, where they're providing that integration a capability to a variety of providers instead of just simply, you know, choosing the one that they acquired. So yes, there's definitely a lot of movement towards that. You know, Constellation's a good example of that. Sandbox Banking out of Boston, another good example, focusing more on the banking side.
Yeah, I mean, two things, and we're going to have to take it to break here in a second, but I would say, number one, to Jim's point, I mean, that's kind of the history of Fiserv, FIS, and Jack Henry, right? They rolled those up to become the platforms. There's this unbundling and bundling process. And the other thing, Ron, I agree with your point, and where I was going with my question back to you was individual institutions, how many of them are really good at making and integrating acquisitions? And I think a group like CUNA Mutual Group makes a very different argument, which you made very well as well. So, all right, well, let's leave it there with all the news. So thanks, Ron, Penny, and Jim. We're going to come back after the break and talk about that personalization. So, again, first name, percent sign, 20, last name, you stay tuned, because we've got this customized just for you, and we'll be back right after this with more Breaking Bank. Thanks.
Become our friend on Facebook. Post your thoughts about our shows and network on our timeline. Visit Facebook.com/Voice America.
The Voice America Live Events Channel is here now to showcase your corporate, individual, or organization's live event. Visit voiceamerica.com/live events to see all of our past live events and find out more. Whether it's a multi-day conference, special speaker, or single-day event, we've got everything to make your event a success. We can do a few hours or a few days. For more information about taking your event to the next level, call Jeff Spinard at 480-294-6417 or email info@voiceamerica.com. Again, that's Jeff Spinard at 480-294-6417 or send us an email to info@voiceamerica.com. Voice America is where you are and where you want to be. Join us around the globe as we broadcast live from some of the most interesting events available. Don't forget to view all our live events, including on-demand access to past events that you may have missed by visiting voiceamerica.com/live events.
Now you don't have to stay linked to your desktop or laptop. Take Voice America on the go and listen anywhere. Get our mobile app for iPhone, BlackBerry, or Android at the Apple iTunes App Store, BlackBerry App World, or Android Market.
You're listening to Breaking Banks featuring your host, Brett King. To reach the show today, please call 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or join the conversation on Twitter by using the hashtag Breaking Banks. Now, back to the program.
Well, welcome back to Breaking Banks. The second half of today's show is sponsored by Bank 4.0. That's the latest book from Brett King. In it, Brett explores the radical transformation already taking place in banking, and it follows it to its logical conclusion. What will banking look like in 30 years or 50 years? In Bank 2.0, Brett presciently coined the phrase that banking is no longer somewhere you go, it's something you do. And Bank 4.0 is the final volume of the series exploring the future of banks amidst the evolution of technology and highlights the beginnings of this revolution already at work. Well, all right, in the second half of our show, we are going to talk about personalization. And Ron, a couple of weeks ago, you published in the Cornerstone Insight Vault a piece that you call The Five Problems with Personalization. And you cited in there a study from Karen Young at the University of Birmingham that was published in the Journal of International Data Privacy Law, which listed five problems of personalization as exploitation, manipulation, marginalization, injustice, and narcissism. Can you define those briefly and kind of set the stage for what are the issues with personalization? Because it seems like it's a good idea. Why might it not be?
Sure, except that it would take a long time to kind of give definitions of each of the five. So let me just kind of give the high level around it, which is fundamentally at the core of each of these five problems is the potential misuse and imbalance of power regarding the use of data. So for a marketer, whether it's a financial firm or retailer or really anybody doing the personalization, it requires a fair degree of data about the person who is being personalized for, whether it's a personalized message, a personalized offer, a personalized product. So it opens up the door, while it always sounds great, hey, we're going to be doing personalization and it's going to benefit you, JP, because it's going to be personalized advice exactly for you, what you need. The fundamental reality here is that because you have the data, there is the opportunity for misuse. I may make you an offer that's personalized based on the data I know about you that is in my best interest, not your best interest. Or I may use that data to nudge you, to manipulate you, to do things that benefit me or somebody else and not necessarily you. So at the core of each of these problems is really, it's all about data and the realization that there is this potential misuse for data. And what got me going in this is, for a long time, I have felt like the whole personalization thing has been this unsupported, undocumented buzzword. And there were a couple of things, and actually it was Jim's report that I read that got me talking about this. He cited a study from Boston Consulting Group that defined the organizational barriers to personalization. And in their study, 3/4 of respondents said that the most frequently cited barrier was too few personnel dedicated to personalization, which got me thinking, how is throwing more people at personalization going to solve anything? And in this list of 12 factors or barriers, nowhere was there any mention of having the right data to drive personalization or understanding what the customer wants personalized. So I was like, this is kind of nonsense. And then there was a picture from McKinsey on how to do personalization with factors like assembling rich data. I mean, what does that mean to the average executive? Do you have poor data that you use for things? And that you're supposed to mine data to identify consumer signals along the journey, ignoring the fact that most financial firms have very little data about what the consumers are doing along the journey. Then there was test and learn in an agile way, as if you're learning and testing in a non-agile way. And finally, you just measure and embed learnings in existing systems, which of course is totally a ridiculous recommendation to make for the vast majority of financial institutions who can't just simply embed things in the existing systems. So, you know, I really wanted to kind of address this fantasy that personalization was going to be this panacea that was going to, you know, make everybody's marketing results look great. When AI and machine learning just magically come along, when the reality is that the data to drive this stuff is not there, and huge potential for the misuse and inappropriate use of a lot of the data that could be applied to this. So go ahead, Jim. Tell me where I'm wrong.
You silence Jim. That's not something that happens very often.
Oh, my gosh. Okay. I win.
We must do. He must have dropped off for a little bit.
I can even take it off mute, which would make a big difference.
There we go. Jim, that's fabulous. Digital.
There we go. So I think the challenge is not that we should personalize. It's a matter of how we personalize. And I think that's what you're saying also, Ron, is that, you know, most banks basically, just as you said, suck at personalization. And the challenge there is, how do you collect data to be able to make personalization work? And Amazon obviously has done very well at it. But one of the things we found when we did the digital bank report called The Power of Personalization in Banking was that it does take data. And when you start looking at organizations that are making headway, I think you look, unfortunately, for better or worse, a lot of times at the bigger banks, because, you know, I'll say Bank of America and Wells Fargo and Capital One are all doing some very interesting things in the onboarding process. So right after the customer opens an account, instead of just selling the next most likely product, they're engaging consumers into building their own account to be able to allow the bank then to personalize communication thereafter to build more engagement. So really what we're looking at is you can't just, you know, take the data and say, okay, I have all I need, now I'm going to personalize everything. But at the end of the day, what it really means is, I'm going to do a better job of collecting the right data to provide the next best action as opposed to the next best product. And you know, I think when you look at personalization, let's look at an automobile. You know, I use the example of a 2016 to 2018 Toyota. They personalize your experience in every way, ranging from where your seat goes to even how you're driving and how you should adjust. And they, you know, the accident awareness systems that these cars have is a very personalized experience as well. They get you in your lane. They make it so you avoid an accident. And that's really where personalization can get really powerful in banking is, how do you use the information you have about me to help me avoid accidents or take advantage of opportunities?
So, Jim, you know that I am that of the many things that bug the hell out of me, the indiscriminate use of buzzwords bugs the hell out of me because they are not very well defined. So it sounds to me a little bit like what you were talking about was customization, not necessarily personalization, unless, of course, customization is part of personalization. And, you know, even the study from Karen Young that I cited was interesting that she was really knocking the use of data not even personalization. She was just lumping all this analysis and analytical use of data as personalization. That anybody who was making an offer based on data analysis, she was considering that personalization. So it's interesting that even as you kind of argue for personalization, you're lumping everything you want to lump into its definition. And on the other side, those who are arguing against it, like Ms. Young, again, using whatever arguments they have with the use of data and bundling it into the personalization argument. You know, I think as a bank executive, you sit there, you got to ask, what is personalization? What isn't it? And what is the incremental benefit of doing this? It all sounds great. It all sounds good. But, you know, the whole talk about one-to-one marketing has been around for 20 years now, 25 years. And reality is that
1993,
it was. There we go. 25 years.
One-to-one future. Yeah.
Yeah.
I would argue here that customization is a customer's choice, and personalization is potentially from a bank or from an Amazon or someone who's, you know, having your data to provide you value, that tailored, you know, product that you might want or need. I'd love to bring Penny into the conversation and just have a little chat about, is there anyone doing this well when we look in the bank and credit union arena? Any examples perhaps that you might have seen, Penny?
Thank you so much. I think it's been really interesting discussion, and I agree that it's really hard to do this, and banks are not good at it. They don't have their data. They don't have the real-time data integrated in the way they need to have it in order to have these really personalized insights. But I would also argue, because you're not good at it doesn't mean you shouldn't try. And I feel like Amazon really wasn't that great at personalization when it first started, at least in my experience. My recommendations were not that good in the beginning, but they got better and better and better at it. One bank that I think is doing interesting things is TD Bank. They've been using geolocation and tying geolocation data to transaction data and other customer data. So, for instance, when a customer is walking past a bank branch, if they've got a mortgage that's up for renewal, they will be pushed an invitation to come into the branch and talk to a loan officer about renewing that loan. Mm. And when the customer's at the airport, they might get a message about their Air Miles card, and they might get an offer for travel insurance. And they even have built something for commuters, where commuters will get an update on the train that they normally take. You know, it's running 10 minutes late, it'll be on track 15. And, you know, in some of these examples, the bank is not even getting anything out of it. It's not using the data. It doesn't push a product always. You know, in the commuting example, they're just providing something that they think will be valuable to the customer.
Useful information. But I mean, that's the privacy piece has to come in. And I think it's fantastic what TD have done, but I am considering, you know, myself walking past a branch and I immediately getting an alert saying, Chloe, would you like to relook at your mortgage? I don't know how I feel about that. What does everybody else think?
But totally, Chloe, agree that that is, go ahead, Ben.
Yeah, you also have the possibility, Chloe, of saying, okay, so TD has some rewards programs at merchants. So you're walking down the street, it says, oh, by the way, Chloe, I don't know if you're interested, but they kind of know what your buying habits are. And they say, by the way, we have a relationship with XYZ store, and if you go in there today and let them know you're a TD customer, you're going to get 20% off. Now,
But you guys are talking about theoretical stuff. Here's the question, Penny, I'd ask you related to TD. So they have this capability to hit you with a message as you walk by the branch if you have a mortgage coming up or whatever it might be. The key question is, how many people are actually walking into the bank branch? How many people are actually doing this? What's the effect? What's the impact? What's the return on this investment? And that's an important part too, which is, how much is it costing TD to develop this capability relative to the number of refis or new mortgages that they're generating from this. So it sounds great. Whoa, super cool use of technology. We got to have an ROI on this thing. There has to be some impact and benefit. And so is TD publishing the numbers of how many people are actually walking in and how much it's cost them to do that? That's the key piece. And until then, it's all sounds really nice and it's a cool use of technology, but it's got to have an ROI.
Well, we have to go beyond the coming into the brand. So we could, Ron, USAA has a program where if because of the location analysis, when you walk into a car dealership, they're going to tell you, simply do a scan of a car you're interested in. We're going to give you the best offer we can on that car loan that will compete with what the dealer is doing. And I'm telling you that you're not walking into the branches there, but using technology to personalize the experience and make the experience better. When I walk into a plane this last week and I'm watching sat in the Delta seat, a flight attendant came up to me, or flight, whatever they call them now, came up to me and said, "Oh, congratulations, Mr. Lewis, on hitting the platinum." Well, that's kind of special. It does make that experience better than it would be otherwise. To walk into a hotel that I did last week and find out that Marriott is actually monitoring the temperature I have the room at when I leave the room, to preset it when I make a reservation, so that it's at the temperature I prefer to be when I show up. That's pretty cool stuff.
I think that means you've hit the big time, Jim. Do they leave you blue only M&Ms?
Oh no, they didn't.
I'm joking.
He's putting that in his contract.
This is a conversation about personalization, right? That's the conversation we're having.
Yeah. The other thing that I think you guys are not taking into account here is looking forward is what regulatory environment are we going to be in relative to the use of data? More and more people are getting freaked out by the use of data. The problem is that, we're always concerned about our PII, our personal identifiable information, getting into the hands of the wrong people. But the reality has become is that I don't even need your PII to figure out who you are. Look at what happened a couple months ago with Google and MasterCard, where they were figuring out basically, without the PII, who it was that was, doing various searches and visiting various sites. They were able to, and making particular purchases. They were able to sort of, put the data together and figure out who people were directly without even having the PII. And you've got to think about going down the line 5-10 years, what kind of environment are we going to be in terms of the use of data to do these things and how that data is being utilized. I think we're going to be in a much more restrictive environment over the next couple of years around the use of data. And sure, some of these things are nice, Jim, but I thought this was breaking banks, not breaking hotels. So, I think we should stick to the financial examples, not the hotel and airline examples.
Well, I gave you one on USAA, and there's other examples. I think we also have to realize that the privacy regulations that are already in place in the UK are a great example. And I'm going to contend that gives you the opportunity to opt out of the sharing of data. On the other hand, it also raises a bar that says financial institutions are going to have to start bringing better value for when they do use data. So, I gave the example of Amazon as being one that, people are willing to pay $125 a year to get more personalized and better offers. It used to be that they wanted free shipping, but now that's a barrier. There's no barrier to entry there because Walmart, Target, and everybody else are doing that. So I think what you're looking at is, you look at the way that Capital One and Wells Fargo and Bank of America today are really personalizing their onboarding process, and I'm sure they're getting better sales because of it. Rather than
okay, but you're just assuming they are. The other thing that we haven't discussed, and funny thing is that we think of personalization as being this technology-driven thing that's only been around for 10 years, but personalization has been around for a long time during the sales process. It's just that the data was collected in different ways. It was collected face-to-face. And so you sat down with a salesperson, you told them what your needs and preferences were, and then you tended to have both a personalized experience and perhaps even personalized advice and offers. What's different about the environment today around personalization is that it's personalization based on inference. A Google, an Apple, so forth, inferring what your needs and wants are based on the data they have versus explicit explanation and delivery of the needs and wants themselves by the consumer. So when you go into that hotel room, Jim, and you set it at 69 degrees because you like it nice and cool in those hotel rooms, you're in effect telling the hotel what you want. And so them setting it afterwards is nice. But a lot of the controversy around personalization has to do with the inference of what your needs and desires are without you having explicitly stated it implicitly or explicitly stated it. And I think that's what some of the naysayers, and I'm kind of on the fence on a lot of this stuff. I don't agree even with Ms. Young about some of the things around exploitation and marginalization, but I just wanted to kind of bring those arguments to light.
Part of that, though, is it's whether it's implicitly or explicitly gathered, it's also about trying to scale this in a digital world, right? So I hear from a lot of banks that say, we already personalize. We know all of our customers by name, and we use their name when they come into the branch and all of that. Well, great. What happens when they stop coming into the branch, and how do we scale this across that? So I think it's... I think there are a lot of angles on where this is today and where it needs to go. But was that Penny or Chloe trying to chime in? Sorry.
Yeah, Penny is jumping in there. Yep.
Yeah, go ahead, Penny.
Yeah, I was just going to say sometimes I think because of all the challenges we've talked about, personalization could just come in very small forms. Like I was talking with the chief commercial officer at Capital this morning, and, they've got a app for investing and saving and setting goals and monitoring your spending and so forth. And one of the things they do is just let you set your goals. For instance, he set up a college savings account for his daughter and attach and populate that goal with a photo. So he has a picture of his daughter. So when he logs into his app, he sees these photos related to his various goals, and he gets an update on, you are this percent of the way toward reaching your goal. And so it's not super creepy or Big Brother-ish, but it's just giving you a kind of a personal look at the your finances and your goals and what you're trying to do. So to me, there could be smaller examples like that of where personalization could work without violating data privacy rules and, causing the problems Ron was talking about.
Yeah, that's more like the care factor, I think, Penny, that you're raising there. As in that touches the heartstrings a bit, right? And that's very clever. And I think the introduction of PFM tools for all of those kinds of activities really does bring the personalization in, as you say, not a creepy way.
Sure.
Well, and what is? Go ahead, Penny. We've got just a couple of minutes left, but go ahead, and I want to maybe ask one last question to the group before we close. Go ahead.
I was just going to add to Jim's example of USAA. They're also analyzing all their customer calls to understand what people's problems are, so that they can be there at the time that a customer has a problem that needs to be fixed, and be more aware of that in all their channels.
Yep. And Jim, maybe I'll just point this last question to you. This has been a great discussion. How does this intersect with privacy? If you think about something like Facebook, which was, probably the best company in the world at mass customization, and users were initially happy to share all kinds of details about themselves. And now a lot of people are thinking maybe that's not such a great idea. I would be completely off of Facebook myself, except for a couple of reasons why I can't. It's the old Godfather 3 story. But where does personalization, the benefits kind of hit into the big wall of privacy, Jim?
Well, it's interesting. When you talk about Facebook, the problem that Facebook got into is, number one, it was not overtly aware. People are not overly aware that they were taking all the different discussion you're having to turn it into marketing, okay? So there's a misunderstanding of how it's going to be used. Number two, it was used in a political way. Okay, so that did not win for anybody. And thirdly, there was very little value provided for the use of that data. It's the difference between Amazon and Facebook. Amazon, at least you know that when they are taking your information, you're getting value from that. Google, you know, just a few years ago, you'd go to the second, third, or fourth page to find what you're looking for. Now, in most cases, it's very unusual for you to need to go to the beyond the first page. And oh, by the way, if you do the exact same Google search as everybody else on this call, we're all going to get a different front page. So again, it's what value do you get from that? And I think that's where the privacy laws in the UK right now are playing well in that. It's making companies look and say, how can we provide value for the consumer? Because they now know more than ever, they can take that right away and they can make it so you'll never be able to communicate with them. So it's, you know, again, like the opt-out on direct mail and email is that if you don't do well with it, then you're going to be considered the worst common denominator, and you're going to be taken off the list.
Well, and the UK government now has a treasure trove of Facebook internal documents, and I think the tide is going to continue to turn away from that. And you bring up a good point, Jim, similar to what Ron had said, that there's a big difference between the explicitly shared information and the implicitly gathered, and it hits that kind of creepy factor that a lot of us talk about. Well, we have hit the end of our time, so thanks to Chloe, Penny, Jim, and Ron all for joining us this week. As always, we appreciate your feedback and suggestions from our listeners, so you can always find us on Twitter at BreakingBanks1, or you can email us at info@provoke.fm. And let us know, too, if you're interested in sponsoring a show or a segment. Our sponsors make the show possible. And before you jump to the next podcast, as always, want to remind you, if you haven't yet, take now to give us a 5-star rating on your favorite podcast platform. That really helps others find the show and to spread the word. And the show continues to grow thanks to all of our listeners. And don't forget, you can listen to all of our more than 250 shows, actually working our way up to 300 episodes of Breaking Banks alone this year, later next year, and plus episodes of Jason Hendricks' FinTech 5 podcast, my own Serial Entrepreneur, and of course, Breaking Banks Asia Pacific with Simon Spencer, all at provoke.fm. So that's it for this week, and we'll see you again next week with more Breaking Banks.
You've been listening to Breaking Banks with host Brett King. Please be sure to join us again next Thursday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time, for more of the latest in fintech news.